Zechariah chapter 8, and we'll pick up in verse 3 here tonight. And let me review just a little bit before we get into this. Like we said before, the 7th and 8th chapters are kind of a distinct section in the book. The book's not all written at the same time, and so we had these first 6 chapters are mostly taken up with the series of visions that Zechariah had. And then we jump 2 years later when we have the 7th and 8th chapters. And of course, in the 7th chapter, we had some people who had come to the priest with a question about religious observances. And they asked him if they had to go ahead and keep the fast in the 5th month like they had for the last 70 years. The fast in the 5th month commemorated when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar's forces. And so the question there was, since they're now back in the land, God has blessed them to come back from captivity, and they started building the temple. They had fits and starts for a while, but now God has sent Haggai and Zechariah to prophesy to them, and he sent Joshua and Zerubbabel to be leaders. And all of that put together has gotten the people underway again. And so they've been working on the temple. They're about 2 years in. And the question comes up, since we're building a new temple, do we still have to commemorate the fall of the old one with weeping and fasting? And it's a really interesting question because it raises the whole topic of religious observance and how that's supposed to work. And the question is not directly answered immediately. Now, we're going to find an answer to it in chapter 8 eventually, but at first they're just answered with another question. Zechariah asked them this. This is the word from God. When you fasted and mourned in the 5th and the 7th month, even those 70 years, did ye at all fast unto me, even to me? In other words, why were you doing it? Your motivation is much more important than the action. And were you doing it to honor me? Is that why you fasted all this time? Or was it because to satisfy your own religious itch? God had never told them to keep this fast. Or when he gives them the reply, he mentions two fasts, the 5th and the 7th month. When we get into chapter 8, we'll find two more mentioned. But that's the question. Was it just for yourselves? Was it to satisfy yourselves? And boy, that's a big question. We spent a lot of time talking about this last week. That's a big question with regard to our religious services right today, isn't it? Do we really do it to honor God, or do we do it to make ourselves feel better? I remember several years ago, Joel Osteen's wife said something. I can't remember what it was verbatim, but the gist of it was, when we come to church to worship, we don't do that for God, we do that for ourselves. Now, I will give her credit for probably being honest. Okay, but that's not how it should be. We're supposed to do it to the glory of God, do all things to the glory of the Lord. And all religious observance, whatever we do, if we come to church, we're actually not supposed to come to church to make ourselves feel better. We're supposed to come to church to glorify God and to edify others. That's the main purpose. If we do that, generally speaking, God will help you too, okay? But that shouldn't be the focus. And you find this all through the Scripture. This one of the driving forces behind what God wants us to do is actually to turn attention away from ourselves to Him and to others around us. And it's a problem we don't seem to be able to get rid of, right? That's still in the world today. A whole lot of what goes on in religious observance is for self and not for God. So that's the short answer to the question. He goes on to tell them about what he really wanted. He asks them, shouldn't you have heard the words of the former prophets? In other words, wouldn't it have been better to listen to the prophets and straighten up before the temple got destroyed than it would be to fast and mourn after? And he talks about how they wouldn't hearken, and so they go into captivity. Now, in chapter 8, the answer is going to get a lot more expansive. And we started on this last time, and we mentioned then that this chapter is interesting in that it doesn't contain a lot of new material. And we sort of compared it last time to the book of Zephaniah, which was the last of the minor prophets before the captivity. Because, as we said then, a lot of Bible critics have complained that Zephaniah doesn't have a lot of new ideas that the other prophets didn't have. And what they're missing is that was the point. He was the last one before they're taken into captivity. And his job, to a great extent, was to remind them of things the earlier prophets had told him. So he repeats a lot of those themes that we find in earlier prophets. Now, in the eighth chapter of Zechariah, we're going to have some of the same sort of thing going on, maybe even on a bigger scale, because in the context of this answer, and this answer is getting far bigger than they ever wanted or expected, right? They just wanted the yes or no. Do we have to fast in the fifth month or not? Tell us yes or no, let us go on our way. What he's trying to do is remind them that their connection to God was on a basis much more than just a fast here or there. But they're in this covenant relationship with God. God has given them all sorts of promises and for blessing and for cursing, depending on how they behave. And so in the end of the seventh chapter, he's reminded them that the reason why they had to go into captivity was because of their disobedience. But in the eighth chapter, he's going to tell them about why he's restoring them. And so we'll see in this chapter that there's a great deal that comes up from earlier covenants God has made. We mentioned that last time God had made a covenant with the people at Mount Sinai, right? They had committed themselves to obey God. And in the context of that covenant, God had told them he was a jealous God. Later on in Exodus, as we saw last time, he even said his name was Jealous. That's one of God's names, is Jealous. And he has a right to be jealous. These people have entered into a covenant with him. They are, as it's depicted sometimes in the Old Testament, his wife. And if they are unfaithful to him, he has a right to be jealous. And so we'll see his jealousy there. We'll see connections with the covenant he made as they come into the land at the end of the book of Deuteronomy with all the promises of blessing and cursing. We'll see connections with his promises to David regarding the kingdom, and even with his commitment to Solomon, as we saw last time, about how he was going to place his name here at this location. And we'll see how he connects with a lot of other prophecies that are given, some of which we've already talked about. So in this chapter, we won't encounter a lot of new ideas. There are a couple of things that are sort of new to us, but most of it really is a reviewing of the fact that God, in bringing them back, has demonstrated his faithfulness to his promises and that he's never going to break his promises. And this eighth chapter occupies an interesting place here. It links it to the rest of the book. As we get into chapters 9 through 14 later on, that again is another section of the book. We could probably divide that up into maybe about three subsections. But in chapters 9 and 14 especially, we're dealing with future prophecy. From not all of it future from our perspective, but future from Zechariah's perspective at the time, okay? Some of it is ancient history by now for us, but it was future at the time. This chapter has some of that in it. It's sort of telescopes back and forth between some of it has to do with the millennial kingdom. A lot of it has to do with their conditions as they are right now, but the general idea of it is that he's reassuring them that even though he took them out of the land for a while, he intends to fully keep his covenant with them forever. And that's kind of really important if you think about it, because these people who had grown up in Babylon, many of them had been born in Babylon and now have come up to this land. They've been aware of that God could punish his people and send them away. Some of them may have a little trouble believing that God might not do that again, you know, and they'd be worried about whether they have a solid possession of the land. So as we saw last time in the first and second verses, kind of the introduction to this, it says the word of the Lord of hosts came to him. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I was jealous for Zion with great jealousy, and I was jealous for her with great fury. And as we've already seen, God is jealous of the nation because of their covenant with him. But this points out he's not just jealous of the nation. He's jealous of that particular location, Mount Zion in Jerusalem, where Solomon's temple was that was torn down and where they're now building a new temple at this time. He says he wants to make them aware that even though I allowed those enemy invaders to come tear down the temple, this is still my mountain. This is still where I've put my name. And this is still where I intend for my temple to be. And as we said last time, that is a principle that collides with current events right at this moment. Because sitting on that mountain today is the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And if we understand the Bible prophecies correctly, at some point there has to be a new temple built on that mountain in order for all the prophecy to be fulfilled as it's supposed to be fulfilled. And so this is very important. He's jealous of this mountain. He has not given up possession of it. And so that was where we left off last time. And in verse 3, he goes on, "Thus saith the Lord, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain." Now, he has returned to Zion, right? He's allowed the people to come back there, and he's communicating to them in this place, and he's going to dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, he says, and that's probably fulfilled in a number of different ways, but it seems pretty clear that the last part of this verse is ultimately fulfilled in the millennial kingdom, because when he says the city of Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, that's hard to place that anywhere else except for the reign of Jesus Christ, isn't it? Well, when has Jerusalem ever been a city of truth? It would have been hard to call it that even in David's day in some ways, you know? And certainly not when Solomon starts messing around with idolatry and that sort of thing. And many of the kings did. There were times here and there where some of the kings would try to clean things up. But when he says he'll call this a city of truth, that seems to connect us to Jesus Christ himself. And here we come back, again, like I said, a lot of this is sort of review of earlier principles. We come back to an idea that we talked about some in chapter 3. And part of the reason why I wanted to emphasize in chapter 3 some of the things I did was looking forward to this chapter. Now, in chapter 3, that's where we have the vision of Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord in his filthy garments. And the angel of the Lord, which generally in the Old Testament is a pre-incarnate depiction of Christ, Satan is accusing Joshua, and the Lord says unto Satan, "The Lord rebuke thee, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee, is not this a brand plucked out of the fire?" And he goes on and says, "Take away the filthy garments," and tells him to clothe them with a change of raiment. In other words, he makes him clean. This is a picture of salvation. This is exactly what this is. The filthy garment is taken away. In Revelation chapter 19, we're told that the fine linen is the righteousness of saints. That is righteousness that we didn't earn for ourselves, but it's the righteousness of Christ put on us. That's what's pictured here. And we notice at the time that it called him, in the 8th verse of the 3rd chapter, "my servant, the branch." And that connects us with a number of different passages where Jesus is referred to as the branch. And in this one, he's known as the servant, the branch. We saw how later in this book, he's the man who is called the branch. And in Isaiah, he's the branch of the Lord. In Jeremiah, he's the branch of David. And that takes in a lot, doesn't it, to describe what this man is. The idea here is that the one who is able to clean up the high priest is a king. Now, that's a little strange because generally speaking in the Bible, the one who has the power to make a sacrifice to cleanse somebody is a priest. But if the high priest himself is dirty, who can make a sacrifice to cleanse the high priest? Well, it would have to be a priest that's higher than he is. And so that's what we picture here, this priest who is also a king. And then we saw later on in chapter 6, at the end of chapter 6, this is one of the other places the branch is mentioned, how they make silver and gold to make a crown to put on the head of Joshua, which is really interesting again because generally speaking, a high priest didn't wear a crown that belongs to a king. But all of this is pointing toward a king priest. And of course, the great example type of Christ, and some people think it is Christ himself, and that's a debate we've talked about a number of times already. But it's that man Melchizedek who shows up in Genesis chapter 14, who is either a type of Christ or Christ himself, one or the other. And it's hard to tell for sure, honestly, which he is. But in either case, he represents what Christ would do later because he's the king of Salem. He's also the priest of the Most High God. And that makes him unique because later on, when Israel comes around, you couldn't be a priest and a king at the same time. Those two things were separated by family ties. Priest and king were both hereditary offices, and the priests came out of Levi, the kings came out of Judah, and never the twain shall meet, right? Until Jesus comes, and then they meet. So it's interesting there that what this man Melchizedek does is he links together ideas that sin has torn apart. And if you remember at the time, we looked at the 85th Psalm, which I think is a very, very important psalm with connection to this. And in the 10th and 11th verses, he says, mercy and truth are met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. Truth shall spring out of the earth, and righteousness shall look down from heaven. And those are ideas that are a little bit hard for us to understand as people in a sinful world, right? That mercy and truth can meet together. Because we know that as sinners, truth demands that we're judged for our sins. If God's an honest God, he has to make judgment for sin. Otherwise, he's not true. He'd be a liar if he didn't judge sin. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. Well, righteousness demands judgment. It demands that the sin that has been committed be punished. So how can you have righteousness and peace at the same time in a sinful world? Now, this shows us that sin is the great problem, right? Because if there weren't any sin, there wouldn't be any conflict between mercy and truth or between righteousness and peace. As a matter of fact, real righteousness is the only thing that ever will bring real peace in the world. But in a sin-cursed world, it's hard to put those two things together. Now, this is one of those places where Melchizedek is really interesting because his name means King of Righteousness. That's what Melchizedek means. But he's also the King of Salem. That's the place, and Salem means peace. So he's the King of Righteousness and King of Peace at the same time. He pictures the one who can bring those two things together. And of course, that's a picture of Christ, who is the only one who could bring righteousness and peace together. The only way it could ever happen is if he would suffer the righteous judgment of God in our place so that we could have peace with God. And it shows you how terrible sin actually is, because sin is such a terrible thing that it actually creates a conflict between two attributes of God. God is loving and merciful and doesn't want anybody to go to hell, but he's also just and he must punish sin. And if that doesn't tell you how bad sin is, I don't know what would, that it could cause that conflict within God himself, so that the only solution for it is for him to send his son to be the one who brings righteousness and peace together. Now, with all that said, this third verse of Zechariah chapter 3, where we all are tonight, seems to make a sort of a reference to that. He says, he'll dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth. And so this man Melchizedek, who was king of Salem, that seems to be Jerusalem, right? Because Jerusalem basically means the city of peace, or founded on peace. And if you take it that way, the idea is that the city of peace shall be called a city of truth. And it's, I think, goes without saying that for a very, very long time, if it's been hard to find truth in Jerusalem, it's been harder to find peace. It's been a city that's been torn by war and conflict for centuries, millennia, really. And this is what he says he'll do. He says he'll take this city of peace and it shall be called a city of truth. And that's amazing, because in the world today, there are major political figures all over the globe who cast aspersions on Israel for possessing the city of Jerusalem, saying that they've done it dishonestly or that they've stolen the city or something like that. It's really been spoils of war. That's how they ended up there. If they hadn't been attacked, they wouldn't have taken possession of the city. But it's been said by many that they have a dishonest claim to this city. Well, the idea here is this is all going to be resolved one day. And there's not going to be any property dispute over Jerusalem someday like there is now. Everybody will know whose it is and who it belongs to. And it'll be a city of peace and a city of truth. And the mountain of the Lord of hosts, the holy mountain. Everybody will know once again that that's a holy mountain where you go to worship the Lord, the true Lord of Israel. He goes on in verse 4. Fourth and fifth verses are really a beautiful depiction of the millennial kingdom. says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, there shall yet old men and old women dwell in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff in his hand for very age." Now, this implies a few things. One is that this is going to be a place of such peace and prosperity someday that it'll be natural to live into old age. For a long time, Jewish people living in Jerusalem have lived in fear of having their lives cut short in their youth. And many have. And so there's that. Then this too, there have been lots of times when if you find any people out in the streets, it has to be soldiers, the young and the fit, who are ready to fight, and the old men and the old women have to go inside and hide. He says it's going to be a place of peace then, where the old men and the old women can just walk in the streets without any fear. Every man with his staff in his hand for a very age, he said that basically means they're going to live as old as a natural human lifespan will allow you to live. And it'll be a place of peace and prosperity. It seems to be maybe even apply a lifting of some of the rigors of disease that we're subject to, that the lifespan is going to be extended perhaps. And this is going to be that kind of city then. It's a difficult thing to have to consider, but even in our country today, there are a lot of places where it's just not safe for old people to go. If you're old enough to become an easy target for street criminals, you don't really want to be there. And to think of a place where they can just go and walk about and move in peace and have no fear. Like I said, these are things that God has mentioned before in his prophecies, and they're just sort of being reiterated here. That kind of makes it almost like an anthology or something like that. But God had mentioned things like this in the book of Isaiah, chapter 65, and the 20th verse. He says, "There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed." He says that there won't be an old man that hath not filled his days. Now, that's quite a promise, isn't it? Because none of us know if we'll make it to old age unless we've got there already. You know, and that's the only way you can have a certainty of it. You know, so we just don't know, do we? Unless we do, you know? Yeah, you made it. I always think of Simeon there in the temple when I think of that, because he was the one that was promised that he wouldn't die until he'd seen the Lord's Christ. And what a thing that would be to think that every night when he went to bed, he was the only person in the world who knew he'd wake up the next morning. If he hadn't seen the Lord's Christ, he knew he'd see another day. So anyway, we have that promise, and that's a precious thing. But then it goes on in the 5th verse and gives another precious promise. It says, "And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the streets thereof." And in a way, that's one of the most beautiful verses in the Bible, isn't it? To think that you can just have your young children and just turn them loose in the streets without any fear.
Michael, one time you could do
yeah,
that.
That's just what I was going to say. There was a time a lot of you can remember when you could do that sort of thing around this area. And you can't do it now because there are people out there who are predators. And it's not safe anymore. And to think about what it'll be to be able to do that, not just out in the country, but right in the streets of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
You can let your kids go and play. There will be plenty of children around, which is in itself a wonderful and joyous thing, isn't it? That's one of the great joys of life, is to have children around. And that also is a kind of an image of prosperity, because one of the things that generally happens when nations are torn apart by war or economic distress or things like that is birth rates tend to go down a lot, right? Because people know they're not going to be able to take care of or provide for their children, or don't know if they will be able to. So this is an indication of prosperity. It's been in times when there's great prosperity that you have baby booms and things like that. And it seems like it's going to be that sort of a time then. So it's a great promise of prosperity from the Lord. Now the 6th verse, I like this. It says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if it be marvelous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also be marvelous in mine eyes, saith the Lord of hosts?" In other words, he says, maybe you people I'm talking to are surprised that this could happen. But does that mean it should surprise me? I'm God. I know about these things. And maybe it was marvelous to them because these people, for most of their lives, had never seen anything like this. Most of them had grown up in captivity. What old people were left that had seen the previous city of Jerusalem before it was all torn down had been there in times of war when the Babylonians were making raid after raid, and they weren't really safe. There hadn't been a time of real safety since the time of Josiah, so there's probably not anybody living by this time who had seen Jerusalem in peace and safety. Some of them had seen the former temple, but they probably hadn't seen peace and safety in the nation. And so they didn't know much about this. Now remember, and this will come up here in just a bit, when they first came back to the land and they're failing to build the temple, God withheld prosperity from them because we saw that in the book of Haggai. Remember that God withheld prosperity from them because they were not faithful to finish out the temple. So that was why they were having trouble when they planted their fields. They didn't get the return that they should out of them and so on. And so they didn't really know what prosperity was. And when they heard maybe some of the priests and people like that talk about the promises in the Old Testament about the prosperity that would come on the people dwelling in their land, maybe it did seem like a marvel to them. It wasn't something they'd seen with their own eyes. But what God is telling them is, it may be a marvel to you, it's not a marvel to me. Because God's saying to them, I've done this before. I've given prosperity to this people in this place before, and I promised it to them, and I can do it again, and I will. And I don't know, maybe that's a good verse to be applied down through the ages to all kinds of people, because we sell God short sometimes, I think. There are things that if God did them and we knew about it, it would be a marvel to us, but it's not a marvel to Him. It's the simplest thing in the world. He's able to take care of His people. And all the promises He's made in His Word, He will keep to the letter without any exception. And that's what He's trying to get them to understand. Remember, this whole thing starts with this question about whether they're supposed to keep this fast. And I think what He's trying to get across to them is your religion has shrunk your perception of God so small that all you think about is a fast. And you haven't seen the scope of who I am and what I can do and what I've promised to you. You haven't grasped this yet. And all you can think about is, well, if I don't keep this fast, is God going to not take away our prosperity again? You know, is He going to punish us again? And so they're having trouble seeing and understanding all this. So He says in verse 7, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country. Now, that is a very unusual statement.
Is it referring maybe to when He's going to call the Jews out of all the places? Yeah.
Been
exiled to, for lack of a better...
This is a grand universal promise. Okay, this is not talking about just bringing back the people who went to Babylon and the people who went to Egypt, because remember, He wasn't going to bring them back. There were some of their descendants that seemed to have come back. But remember, when He talked about the people that they had dealings with that were their enemies, it was generally always on a north-south axis. It was Egypt from the south, Syria, Assyria and Babylon from the north, even though we know if you look at a map and draw a line on a map, it's closer to east, but they had to come around from the north because of the geography. So when we talk about them being taken into captivity, they're taken into the north. That's how we phrase this. Now, when He says He's going to bring His people from the east country and from the west country, that's a very unusual thing to say, because if you're standing on Mount Zion, if you're in Jerusalem, the east country, if you can cross over the Jordan River and you can go east for a little way, but not very far before you come to the Arabian Desert. And it's pretty barren and empty. And if you go west, immediately west, there's no country at all. It's the Mediterranean Sea. And it would seem to be that the reason for saying east country and west country rather than north and south is because he wants to make it clear he's taking in the scope of the whole earth. Because there's country out past the Mediterranean Sea, and there's country out past the Arabian Desert. You can go east and west, all the way around the world. And the Jews have been scattered all the way around the world. There aren't many places in this world where you can't find Jewish people. And he says he's going to bring them back from all over. And we haven't seen the fullness of the fulfillment of that yet. But in our lifetimes, we've seen a substantial beginning to that. There has been, in the last 50 years, an extraordinary drop in the number of Jews in Europe because so many have come home. And so it's gone now. I think I read somewhere that in the late 1800s, 90% of the Jews of the world were in Europe, and now it's down to like 9% because most of them have either come to the United States or gone back to their homeland. And so I think it's 81 or so percent of all the Jews in the world who have sufficient enough Jewish ethnicity to have automatic citizenship in Israel. About 81% are either in the United States or in Israel at this point.
And a whole bunch of them in New York City.
Yeah, there's a lot in New York City. And so, this has been an extraordinary return that we've seen already. There's been a massive return in the last 50 years because as the Soviet bloc fell, a lot of the people who were more or less imprisoned in those countries have made their way back to their homeland. And so we see this already coming to play. It hasn't been finished yet, but it will be one day. He's going to call all his people back together into his place.
Isn't it amazing that all over the world there are Jews that probably don't know they're Jews?
Yeah.
God knows exactly where they are.
That's right, because and you wonder how many there are who don't know they're Jews, because there have been of course lots of times and places where people tried to cover up their Jewish ethnicity because it was dangerous for them to be recognized as Jews. And so probably only God really knows. So that's an incredible thing to think about, that he's still got a record book and he knows where these people are. He says, I will bring them and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. We have that truth and righteousness put together again. And I want to notice also in this verse and the one before it, he calls them my people. Now, once again, this is a sort of a callback to an earlier prophet. If you remember when we started in this study of minor prophets way back whenever that was, the very first one we looked at was Hosea. And remember, Hosea married this wife of whoredoms that God told her to marry, and she had these three children. And one of them was named Jezreel, one of them was named Leruhamah, and one of them was named Lo-Ami. And the third one, Lo-Ami, was that means not my people. So in chapter 1, verse 9 of Hosea, then said God, call his name Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I will not be your God. And that's what he told them because of their disobedience. But the wonder is that because of the grace of God, and this is all connected with what Christ did on Calvary, by the way. This wouldn't be possible if it weren't for his grace. But in chapter 2, verse 23 of that book, he says, and I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, thou art my people, and they shall say, thou art my God. So the ones who were called Lo-Ami, not my God, he says, thou art my people. Well, we find this again in the book of Zechariah. This is what he's doing in this chapter. He's reminding them of all these promises. He says in the 8th verse, they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. Verse 9 says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, let your hands be strong, ye that hear in these words, these days, these words by the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day of the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid, that the temple might be built. Now, in chapter 7, when they first asked the question about whether they were supposed to keep all those fasts, he said, should ye not hear the words which the Lord hath cried by the former prophets? This is chapter 7, verse 7, when Jerusalem was inhabited in prosperity. He said, shouldn't you hear the words that the prophet spoke way back when, before you went into captivity, you should hear those if you want to know your answer to that question. Now he says, you also need to hear the words that the prophets in your day are speaking. When he says, ye that hear these words in the mouth of the prophets, which were in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid, he's talking about Haggai and Zechariah. Those were the two key prophets at this time. And remember, one of the key components of both of their prophecies was to encourage them, because God had promised them that he would finish this work of the building of the temple in them. In Haggai 2:4, he says to Zerubbabel, yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Josedech, the high priest, and be strong, all you people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. And so he reminds them of that. It's been a couple of years since they got that prophecy, so it's long enough to forget a little bit. And he says to them again, let your hands be strong, just like I told you 2 years ago. That promise is still in effect. Just keep working. In verse 10, for before these days there was no hire for man, nor any hire for beast, neither was there any peace to him that went out or came in because of the affliction. For I set all men, everyone, against his neighbor. He reminds them that before they started building this temple, this is in the book of Haggai. We covered this a while back. When they had just laid the foundation, but they had built their houses. They had their houses all finished out and looking nice. Haggai chapter 1:4, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Ye have sown much and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. He says, your economy is a wreck and you don't understand why. That's the idea. You work hard, you labor, but you can't get anything out of your labor. You get a little money and you put it in a bag with holes. You wonder where it went, you know. Anybody ever feel like that? You just wonder where your money went. It disappeared. You don't know what happened to it. And he says, the reason this happens is because you're disobedient to God. You haven't built this temple. Now they've heard the rebuke from God, and they've started to build the temple, and God has restored them to prosperity. It's been a couple of years gone by. It's funny how quick you can forget good times or bad times, really, you know. I always thought that was a kind of a funny thing. It's been a tradition in the United States every time we have a presidential election. For decades, as long as I can remember in my lifetime, they always ask, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And honestly, goodness, there's times it's hard to remember, right? Because that was 4 years ago, you know? and you try to think back. I can't remember exactly how it was 4 years ago. And you start to think about it, you know? Yeah, right. Yeah, 4 years ago. 4 years ago from this particular date, it's a little bit easier to mark out in your mind. But it's sometimes hard to remember, isn't it? I mean, yeah, you try to think back to, it's strange now, but it hasn't been that long. But if you try to think how things were in, 2007 or 2014 or something like that, it's the years start to blend together, and it's kind of hard to remember sometimes, you know. And so much has changed in recent years, it almost seems like a different world back then anyway. But it's been 2 years, they seem to have forgotten. God has prospered them, and they seem to have forgotten that just 2 years ago, you couldn't make a living for anything, you know. And now this prosperity has been restored. He wants to remind them of that and remember how it was. And he says, verse 11 of Zechariah chapter 8, but now I will not be unto the residue of this people as in the former days, saith the Lord of hosts. He says, it's not going to be like that because you've been faithful to me and you've started to build the temple. And so we're on a different basis now. For the seed shall be prosperous, the vine shall give her fruit, and the ground shall give her increase, and the heavens shall give their due, and I will cause the remnant of this people to possess all things. Now, again, we have this theme that keeps coming up in this chapter. He's reminding them of prophecies that he made all the way back in the Old Testament. Earlier in the Old Testament, still Old Testament, before the captivity, way back before they came into the land. The first time in Deuteronomy chapter 30, and these chapters 28, 29, 30 of Deuteronomy all deal with this covenant he made with them before they go into the land, and he tells them about how they'll be cursed if they disobey and how they'll be blessed if they obey. But in the 30th chapter is a beautiful one. It says, "And it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, whether the Lord thy God hath driven thee, and thou shalt return unto the Lord thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thine heart and with all thy soul, that then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations, whether the Lord thy God hath scattered thee." He says, it's kind of an amazing thing. God doesn't say that if you sin and I have to send you somewhere else, and if you do, he says, no, you're going to, this is going to happen, that you're going to come into this time when the curse comes upon you, and I'm going to carry you into this place. But the promise is, when you'll return to me, when you'll repent, I'll bring you back. I'll turn your captivity. I'll gather you from wherever I've scattered you. The fifth verse says, "And the Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it, and he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers." Isn't that amazing? He says, I'll bless you more even than I blessed them back then when I bring you back to this place. And he goes on in the ninth verse and says, "The Lord thy God will make thee plenteous in every work of thine hand, in the fruit of thy body, and in the fruit of thy cattle, and in the fruit of thy land for good, for the Lord will again rejoice over thee for good, as he rejoiced over thy fathers." So when we come to Zechariah chapter 8, again, he's just reminding them of promises he's already made. That's what he said. I told you that when I brought you back, I would prosper your seed and your vine and your ground. And that's exactly what I mean to do. It says in verse 13, "It shall come to pass that as ye were a curse among the heathen." Now, that's another thing he promised them in the book of Deuteronomy, right? That they would become a curse. And the idea is, even that they become a sort of byword among the heathen. They were so persecuted that when the heathen would curse somebody else, they would ask their gods to make them like the Jews, because the Jews had been so, their land had been so thoroughly destroyed. And he says, "O house of Judah, O house of Israel, so will I save you, and ye shall be a blessing. Fear not, but let your hands be strong." He says, just as one time people regarded you as the cursed among the earth, I'm going to bring you back, and it's going to be so clear to the other nations that this has to have been done by the hand of God, that you'll become a blessing. So fear not, but let your hands be strong. Just put yourself to the work. I promised you I would do this. Don't fear. "For thus saith the Lord of hosts, as I thought to punish you when your fathers provoked me to wrath, saith the Lord of hosts, and I repented not, so again have I thought in these days to do well unto Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Fear ye not." He raises a point here that we've talked about once or twice before, that as strange as it sounds, one of the greatest guarantees of the mercy and blessing of God is the punishment of God. Because if God kept his promise when he said he was going to punish you, you can believe he'll keep his promise when he says he's going to bless you too. And Israel had certainly had this. Now, again, like we say, we're sort of taking a tour of prophecies and promises and covenants that God has made with his people. And this is one of them in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 29. We talked about this before. The 11th verse of chapter 29 says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end." And like we said before, it's actually kind of funny because you see that a lot on inspirational posters and t-shirts and things like that. And probably a lot of people don't understand the context that at the time what he was telling them was, you need to go into captivity for 70 years. that's the plan. But at the end of 70 years, if you will submit to that, I'll bring you back in peace, because I know the thoughts I have of you, of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. So you will come back someday. Now, what that tells us is this. In this chapter, we find out in the first part of this chapter that he promised them with absolute certainty that they were to go into captivity. Verse 4 of that chapter says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, unto all that are carried away captives, whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem unto Babylon, build ye houses and dwell in them, plant gardens, eat the fruit thereof, take ye wives, etc., etc. He says, you're going to Babylon, you might as well go there and settle down, right? Because that's the plan. But he says, just as sure as I'm taking you away, I will bring you back someday because you're mine. And I haven't given up on you, and I haven't given up on Jerusalem. You're still my people. That's still my city. And so you're coming home someday. And so that's what he tells him here in Zechariah 8:14. Just the same as I thought to punish you and repented not, on exactly the same basis, I have a plan to do well to you, bring you back to Jerusalem. So you can count on that. Don't fear. Verse 16, these are the things that ye shall do. Speak ye every man the truth to his neighbor, execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates, and let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor, and love no false oath, for all these are things that I hate, saith the Lord.
Now, that's what we need to have on
T-shirt. Yeah, right, that's pretty good. it comes back to the same thing. We're talking about how this chapter reviews principles we've talked about before. This raises the same old principle. It is better to obey than to sacrifice. He says to him, remember, the backdrop of all this is still the question they asked, do we have to keep the fast? They never thought they were going to get all this in answer to that question, okay? But they get down to this and he says, it's not your fast I wanted you. I wanted you to act right. I don't want you to weep forever because of your sin. By the way, that's a good point for Christians right now. When you sin, you ought to weep over it and sorrow and confess it. But once it's confessed, you don't need to weep over it anymore.
Don't wallow in it.
That's right. Don't wallow in it because God takes it away. It's forgiven.
Don't let it guilt you
down. And some people are bound up by this as Christians. I've always said that errors usually come in pairs, right? You miss either to the left or the right. What the devil would like you to do as a Christian is not be concerned or bothered by your sin at all. But if he can't accomplish that, he wants you to be so bothered by it that it paralyzes you.
Yeah. You can't let go of it.
Yeah. And there are Christians who are spiritual enough to be bothered by their sins, and they get caught by the trap on the other side. And they can't let go. They can't really believe that 1 John 1:9 is a promise from God. And if you'll confess your sins, he's faithful and just to forgive those sins. And but some people struggle with that. So that's the idea there, is that he doesn't want you to keep wallowing in this fast year after year after year. I guess part of what he's trying to say to them is, I brought you into captivity because of the sins you committed up there, and that's why the temple was destroyed. That's why you had this fast. But that's over with now. That's done. That's not on the agenda anymore. I brought you back. That's finished. So quit thinking about that. Don't make that remembrance of this sin over and over again, because it will make your religion a misery to you instead of a joy. And so he tells him to do that. He tells him just go forth and obey, right? That was, remember the woman taken in adultery? What was his instruction to her? Go and sin no more. That's the idea. So he says, speak ye every man truth to his neighbor, execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gates. Let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor, and love no false oath. They seem to have adopted some habits of dishonesty. I don't know if that came from their time in Babylon or what, but a lot of this has to do with just being honest and not making false oaths and so on. And he says, I hate all those things. That's what I want you to do. I'd rather you do that than go down here the fifth month every year and have a fast. Now, we don't have time to go too much further here tonight, but let me kind of introduce what we'll get into in the last few verses of this. He's going to come back to this subject of fast. We'll see this more next time. And we'll find it's not just the fifth month and the seventh month, but we've got the fourth month and the tenth month added in there too. You don't have to remember all this because we'll mention it again next time. But the tenth month remembered when Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem, and it was under siege for about 18 months. And the fourth month was when they broke down the walls and came into the city. Then in the fifth month was when they tore down the temple. And then, of course, the seventh month was when Gedalia was assassinated. So they had all these fasts. And you couldn't go very long without having a fast. You had one, you know, it seemed like month after month after month you had a fast. There's a lot of sorrow in all of this. And what he tells them is, this is a beautiful thought. When the kingdom comes, when he gets them into the millennium, he's going to take away all those fasts and turn them into feasts. Isn't that amazing? These very days that they had set aside to mourn the things that had come upon them because of their wickedness now are going to be times of joy for them. And if that's not a wonderful picture of God's grace, I don't know what is. Those times that were remembrance of their sin now will become a remembrance of God's deliverance. And shouldn't that be the way it is for us in the Christian life? If we ever remember our old sins at all, instead of remembering or pining away because of our wickedness, we should be rejoicing in the grace of God to forgive us of those things. And if we could learn to do that, wouldn't that give us a lot of joy? There are probably most all of us have things in our life, episodes in our life that we like to keep locked away and not think about any more than we have to, right? Everybody got those things you don't really want to remember.
Because you just can't seem to forget that.
Because you did something and you know it was wrong. That's the worst, right? Even worse than when somebody did you wrong, it's when you did something and you know it was wrong. Yeah. And that's on your mind forever. And wouldn't it be something, instead of thinking that way, we could think that was a marvelous thing for God to forgive me of that. That was an achievement of God's grace, that he could carry me over past that and rejoice in that. It's hard for us to get to that place. But that's the idea, really, of what he's talking to them about on a national basis. That instead of mourning over those times, sometimes they'll rejoice in them because it was through those things that actually God brought them back to himself. And so we'll look at that more next time, Lord willing. We'll stop there for tonight. Does anybody have any questions or comments?